Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Senior Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, I sat down with Dr. Stuart Factor, a professor of neurology and the director of the Jean and Paul Amos Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Program at Emory University School of Medicine, to discuss the swinging pendulum that is the therapeutic pipeline for Parkinson's disease and some of the obstacles that are still standing in the way of providing optimal care to patients. Let's dive in.
Factor. I am a neurologist at Emory University, and I am the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Program in the Department of Neurology at Emory. So there are really a lot of challenges. We have a lot of treatments, and a lot of new treatments have been coming out in the last years, but there are many challenges. Some of them are motor, and some of them are non-motor. So starting with the non-motor, we really don't have adequate treatments for cognitive decline in patients. That's a huge challenge, probably the biggest unmet need. And related to that, many patients have psychosis, hallucinations, delusions. Although we have some treatments for that, they are limited, still a difficult problem to address. Of other non-motor features, many patients have sleep disorders. Particularly fragmented sleep is very common and very difficult to manage. And autonomic dysfunction remains a problem, particularly orthostatic hypotension, which we have several drugs for, but still is difficult to manage, especially in the more severe cases. From a motor standpoint, my interest recently, research-wise, has been with walking issues, gait issues, particularly freezing of gait, which is often just not responsive to any treatments at all and very debilitating, leading cause of falls. And in a large number of patients, we continue to have difficulty treating motor fluctuations. These can be predictable, unpredictable. It's a leading reason why people end up needing surgery. And dyskinesia, which is involuntary movements that in a pretty good portion of patients who have dyskinesia doesn't really respond well to treatment. And we only have one class of medications right now to treat dyskinesia. So that's just sort of a quick run through of the challenges we and our patients face when we're dealing with this disorder.
And obviously, you mentioned, you know, some of these challenges, we do have therapies aimed at addressing, others we do not. And even right. The ones that we do, the therapies aren't always adequate with what right. We have available. So for you, what how would you sort of describe that therapeutic landscape overall? And I mean, you know, if you want to split between the addressing non-motor issues versus motor issues, but do you, obviously, you know, with having a quote unquote gold standard therapy, that's obviously kind of puts you ahead of some other conditions, but as you mentioned, still clearly a number of issues left to address.
Right. So for motor issues, I would levodopa is the gold standard. It is, very potent anti-Parkinsonian drug, but has its issues, particularly in relation to its half-life. And the problems that occur years down the line with wearing off, as we mentioned, and dyskinesias. And it's been great that there have been a number of, there's really been an explosion of new medicines to treat those motor features. Nevertheless, what we're seeing is people going on more and more medications of different types to try and treat this. And yet we still have trouble in adequately controlling this, especially in people in whom those off periods are very disabling. From a non-motor standpoint, I think we're still kind of early in the course. We have one drug approved for hallucinations in Parkinson's. We have the old class of cholinesterase inhibitors approved for cognition. And we have a few drugs available for orthostatic hypotension. And even constipation, I didn't mention earlier, is difficult. And we have some drugs to treat those. But those are still sort of earlier in the course. And while a lot of those drugs can be helpful, at least initially, they're not really adequate to control the over this, you know, the span of time that these people have these issues. I think we're seeing more. For instance, I looked at, the NIH website for clinical trials within the last year and saw some six or seven drugs being tested for cognitive change, which is great. And so I think we have the opportunity to make some headway over the next 5 to 10 years, but we're still kind of earlier in the course with the non-motor drugs.
So, but speaking to that pipeline, would, you know, obviously you mentioned it is, you know, a good sign, certainly, that things are ongoing there. Is there anything in there, you know, that you're sort of marking as noteworthy or you're going to keep an eye? I mean, I would imagine you're watching it as a whole because that's what you need to do. But are there any specific therapies or products in the pipeline that you think might be able to make an impact, you know, in the next few years or at least sooner rather than later?
So many of the drugs for non-motor features are in early phase trials, phase one, phase two. There's been little published on them so far, so I can't really make any specific statements about how they're doing or where they're going, but I'm just keeping an eye on, you know, how many of them there are and how many opportunities there may be. You know, from a motor standpoint, I think, you know, and I'm talking to you based on some of the work that we're involved with, because we're involved in clinical trials in our group. And so some interesting things are, we've kind of, there was this pendulum moving away from dopaminergic drugs and levodopa. And now that pendulum is coming back. And with levodopa still being the gold standard, new formulations of levodopa are being developed in order to have a smoother response instead of this up and down response that leads to fluctuations and dyskinesia. So I think some of those are going to be very interesting. Some of them are, you know, there are oral formulations, there are subcutaneous formulations. So I think that'll be fairly interesting. And then really sort of out there further away, things include gene therapies where they're surgically placing a gene using a viral vector to put in enzymes that modulate the metabolism of levodopa and dopamine so that you can get a smoother response that way and maybe require lower doses. And then further out there from, you know, what I'm reading and hearing is that cellular therapies may be on the return in the next year or two. And I think those would be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, that would certainly be, you know, exciting information to read about. I know sort of across the breadth of medicine, you know, gene and cell therapies are kind of a hot commodity at the moment.
Right. You know, there are, of course, a variety of drugs that are being tested as neuroprotective drugs for Parkinson's, and we've not been very successful in developing those. Most of those trials have failed, and I think we still have a long way to go. The belief now is moving towards that we need a cocktail of drugs because there are multiple mechanisms by which the cells die. But of greatest interest in those is the hereditary forms of Parkinson's disease. The gene LRRK2, LRRK2, and GBA are two of the most common genetic forms, and now drugs specific to those diseases are being developed, which I think could actually change the direction, and we could see a development of neuroprotective agents. But those, again, are in very early phases, phase one, phase two. So we have a ways to go, I think, before we see anything with that. But those drugs and that situation, you know, we have a specific cause and then a specific drug that that affects that pathophysiology. So I think there's a real opportunity there.
And in terms of the therapies that are available, you know, we mentioned, you mentioned sort of these new formulations that are being explored in the pipeline. In terms of, you know, advantages that are existing therapies may or may not have for, you know, specific patients and their needs, are there certain delivery methods that you find are particularly advantageous for, you know, certain patients or that you see that your patients tend to favor over others?
You know, of course, most of what we do now is oral medications, but as we talked about the last time I met with you when we were talking about the rescue drugs, those are the ones that are delivered separately. And so there are three kinds. There's the injectable, which is the older form of apomorphine. And then there's the inhaler, which is a new formulation of levodopa that's out there. And then now apomorphine has come out with a sublingual formulation. So, you know, I can tell you that the less mechanistic it is, the easier it is for patients to do it. I would say that although apomorphine is really a potent dopaminergic drug, it doing an injection is hard for patients, especially if they have tremors or if they have significant bradykinesia and they do need help from a spouse or a caregiver to do those. And it's particularly harder if it's because it's on demand, so they have to be there at the time they need it. It's not scheduled. You know, the inhaler is somewhat easier. However, some patients are not able to, you know, to take a deep enough appropriate breath to get that the whole dose in. And so while some of my patients really like it and they think it works great, some patients just have difficulty with managing with that. And then the sublingual, it, you know, it's kind of easier because you just, it's a strip, you put it under your tongue and you wait for it to dissolve. But patients have to not swallow for 2 minutes, and that's not always easy either. So they have to really be cognitively aware that they can't do this and make sure that they don't, and make sure that the whole thing dissolves in order to get the full dose. So, you know, I think while we went from the tougher to the easier in describing those three, there are still challenges with some patients on some of those.
But of course, you know, having the options, I guess, is ultimately the goal, so you can find what works for who.
The other thing is, you know, with oral medicines, I mean, with current standard forms of levodopa, patients end up needing to take medications every 3 hours, sometimes every 2 hours. And compliance with that, just try taking a drug every 3 hours. I take my medicines once a day and I forget sometimes. So it's a real challenge getting, you know, especially in the advanced cases where timing is everything, you know, that part of it is a big challenge as well. So, and of course, the impact of food and other things that may impact the way drugs are absorbed and things like that, that have to be taken into account.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was actually going to ask, you know, what sort of role that medication adherence plays in sort of, you know, managing patients. That's a thing we talk with, you know, a number of movement disorder specialists about. I know Rajesh Pawa out in Kansas talks to me about it pretty much every time we have a conversation about how much what you're saying, especially when you're taking several doses throughout the day, it's difficult not only just to actively remember, but it's a ton of medication.
Sometimes patients come to the office, they know they're going to be there for a certain amount of time, and they have their drive to the office, the drive back, and yet a dose comes due, and they've forgotten to even bring their medicines. And so, yeah, it's a huge challenge for patients.
So how do you go about sort of addressing that with them? I would imagine that's, you know, you mentioned potentially if they have, you know, maybe a caregiver or a care partner, but is a lot of that, you know, based on communicating with them regularly and kind of keeping up with them? Like, what are your sort of daily practice management tips in terms of keeping
up? Well, I would say that, you know, for the more advanced patients, even for the early patients where missing a dose doesn't matter all that much, I still tell them, you know, that it's really important to get all three doses, that the timing is important because you start telling them early so that they've got it, got the message later. But we talk all the time about, you know, timing is everything, and the need to be consistent with taking their medicines on a regular dose every day. And, you know, we do sometimes talk about meals and how they may impact and what they need to do to adjust for that. So, yeah, that's a consistent, common thing that we talk about all the time.
Do you think that generally there is enough sort of maybe physician education or enough sort of opportunities for physicians, especially those who are sort of just coming into, you know, general regular practice, that to really engage with their patients about these sorts of things?
Yeah, you know, any fellow who comes through our clinic for sure, you know, gets a firsthand look at how timing and is so important. So I think a lot of physicians do. Maybe the people who are not fellowship trained, but they're neurologists in practice, could probably use a little more help in getting a sense of that. And even with the rescue drugs, it's hard to get patients to get a sense of when they should use those. So we try to tell them, as soon as you start feeling like you're going off, you take your medicine then to prevent the real trough. And they still forget to do that, and they wait until they can't move to take their meds. So that's another, now that rescue meds have become a big issue in our practice, that's another big talking point we have.
And then obviously, you know, a big talking point, a big conversation still ongoing, obviously, is the pandemic. I'm curious, has that, you know, affected the way you've managed patients in any way? I'm assuming, you know, there's been some sort of virtual aspect to care that's come in. Have you found that patients respond well to that? Have they adjusted easily? And has that had a negative or positive impact on you know, those things we're talking about with timing and being yeah. you know, on top of your medications?
As far as COVID, yeah, it's been very challenging. I can tell you my own personal challenges. I'm still doing 1 day a week of primarily telemedicine visits. They're all my Parkinson patients. Mm-hmm. Some of them like it and some of them don't, because some of them like it because they don't have to drive in traffic to our office. But some of them don't like it because they like the face-to-face interactions we have. But I think in practice, in general, patients are not finding it as fulfilling. And I think one of the clues to that is we're getting more phone calls, patient phone calls between visits. Normally when I see patients, I type up a list of items for them to do between visits. You can't really do that when you're doing telemedicine. I ask them to grab a pen and paper and write them down. They still don't get it, you know, sometimes. And they end up calling and saying, now, when do I start this one? And when do I change this one? And so occasionally what I do is I ask them for their email address and I type it up and email it to them. But they're all not, especially the elderly ones, are not so email savvy. So that's not so easy. I think many of the new drugs that have come out are specialty pharmacy drugs. That makes it really difficult for us, because there are forms to fill out and there are pre-certifications to do. And I don't have my staff in front of me when I'm sitting in my office at home to do that. So there's often a delay. And then, you know, it just becomes much more difficult to manage. And it takes longer and patients get impatient. I haven't received my my inhaled levodopa yet. When am I going to hear? What am I going to hear? And if we're not talking to our staff every day and, you know, making sure everything's been submitted appropriately, then we don't know. And so, you know, those are some of the things that I think have been difficult. And also we, you know, while it's nice to see them in their home environment, they're not set up for us to do a really good exam. Yeah. you know, finding a place for them to walk in the house can take a few minutes for them to, oh, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? Where will I put the camera? Or they're doing it on their phone and they don't have another person with them. So you can't really examine them while they're holding their phone. I have to tell you, some of my patients, I've done telemedicine visits. They're in their car. They're in parking lots. They're, you know, so it's really challenging.
I mean, I'm sure it certainly gives you the hope that, you know, once you're back in person, at least that, yeah, that perhaps that relationship then will build and grow off of that.
Right. I think the telemedicine is good for shortened visits and, you know, discussing medicines and things like that. But, you know, to really have a good sense in a patient who's having new problems or complicated issues, very often what we do now is, if that's the case, we end up telling them, all right, we're going to bring you in.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge because now we have to create new slots for additional visits and things like that.
You know, is there anything else in terms of whether it's managing patients or, you know, therapeutic conversations that are ongoing that for you is sort of top of mind or that you think, you know, the clinician community as a whole should sort of be keeping an eye on or be aware of?
You know, one of the things that's been on my mind lately, and I'm not even sure if this is the right venue for doing this, and you can cut it if you want, but I think we're having a lot of issues getting appropriate treatments to patients because their insurance companies won't support them. Even FDA-approved drugs are being turned down for patients all the time. And I think it's very frustrating for the patients, and it's very frustrating for us because we can't select the appropriate drug for the patient without being told that you have to use this first and this second and this third, and they may not be appropriate. They may not be the same class of drug. And so, you know, that I think from a clinical practice standpoint has been on my mind a lot because it seems during COVID, and maybe it's because in the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, there have been some 6 or 7 new drugs for Parkinson's that have been approved. And maybe it has to do with them being new and newer drugs are more expensive. But they can be very useful. And yet we become frustrated in being able to get them to our patients. So that's what's been on my mind lately from a clinical practice standpoint.
You're certainly not the only physician to mention that to us. I mean, that's been a big, obviously, you know, the migraine space has seen a couple approvals since 2016, 2018, somewhere around there. And it's same issue. And patients are, you know, forced to fail 2-3 other medications and sit there and suffer with their migraines for another, you know, year and a half before they can get out.
And the interesting thing is very often the patient will come to us and say, I'd really like to try this. This just came out. And then their insurance company won't allow them to do that. So, and sometimes we'll say, you know, well, the sublingual apomorphine or the inhaled levodopa would be great for you. Let's fill out the paperwork and do this. And then, you know, weeks go by before you hear whether they can get it or not even. So they've wasted all of this time waiting to hear whether or not they can be on this drug. And it's just, you know, a very frustrating thing. And not to be political, but when a number of political figures got COVID and they were hospitalized, and they were getting all these experimental drugs and all these very expensive drugs. And then we're trying to treat our patients with an FDA-approved drug for their problem, and we can't get them on it. It, you know, what does it tell the patients when they're seeing these two extremes and how difficult it is? One other thing is the pipeline's increasing, but the pandemic has limited enrollment in studies too. And so that has really delayed a lot of studies from finishing. So that's a big issue also. But maybe by the summer, 75% of the population will be vaccinated and we'll be able to feel a little more freer to go out and do more things in the office and live our lives again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.